everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's May 2023, and this is episode 338, which is a conversation about the ethics of the fertility industry. On this episode, I'm joined by Lisa Cooper, who is a senior copywriter at Revelation Media and a freelance writer with Barna. She has a master's degree in religion from the American Lutheran Theological Seminary. Lisa has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and her article is called, "Is Participating in the Fertility Industry Ethical?" And you can read her article for free online at our website, equip.org. Lisa, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Well, this is a very fascinating subject matter, and we are going to be talking, as I mentioned, about donor conception. And so maybe you could clarify that phrase for us. Maybe Christians don't know. I mean, I know they've heard of things like, you know, in vitro fertilization and surrogacy, but what's the whole idea of the topic behind donor conception? And why is it something that you're in particular interested in? And why is it something that you think Christians should note and care about?
Yes. First, I'll answer your first question. Donor conception is anything related to fertility treatments that use a donor to conceive a child. So that would be things like sperm donation, egg donation, IVF would be related, in vitro fertilization, and surrogacy. So in any of those situations, you are introducing a donor into the procedure and not necessarily, you know, just the couple. Although a lot of the fertility treatments may use, you know, a husband's sperm to impregnate the wife. But there, yeah. So when we're talking about donor conception, it has a lot to do with, like now, especially like with TikTok becoming more popular, people are coming to terms with their status as a donor conceived person. And on the internet, we're seeing a lot more people coming forward with personal stories about their experience being donor conceived or their problems with fertility. And I think it's becoming more of a thing recently. You know, according to the CDC, 1 in 5 women are unable to get pregnant after a year of trying. And with statistics like those, the fertility industry has just been booming. And I think people should really take some time to examine the industry itself alongside the procedures. And I think there are some excellent articles written in the Christian Research Journal about the procedures themselves. And today we're going to be talking mostly about the industry as an extension of those topics. So if people are interested in ethics of reproductive technologies, Scott B. Ray wrote a great article in the Christian Research Journal. And Heather Ziegler talked about, it's called When Baby Making Takes Three, You, Me, and She. And that article has a lot to do with the ethics surrounding the procedures that would result in a donor-conceived individual. So if people are interested in that, they can read more about the procedures themselves there. But I became interested in this topic because it became more of a thing on social media to see people talking about their status as donor-conceived. And I went on one of those obsessive rabbit holes researching on the internet about it and looking for Christian content that related to the industry itself, because there are lots of, as we'll talk about, there are a lot of ethical issues that seem to be popping up in simply participating in an industry that's unregulated for the most part, or in many ways, I guess. And I couldn't find anything. And I was getting really frustrated that there just weren't Christian materials that were exploring what it means to even participate in the industry, the fertility industry, when when I was looking for it. So that's when I decided to just write it.
And I know you were just mentioning social media, and I've actually noticed this because I have Facebook friends who are struggling with infertility. And, you know, now we find ourselves in the month of May, but last month, at the end of the month, there was something called National Infertility Awareness Week. And it was at the end of April, and there was a special hashtag NIAW2003. And people were encouraged to tell their infertility stories and post those things on, you know, Facebook and TikTok and Instagram. And it was through there that I saw friends that were using that hashtag to tell their stories. And of course, it does involve some of the procedures that you're talking about. And so it's a very big and real thing, and they're trying, and Christians are involved, because the people using this hashtag in my social media feeds were not non-religious people. They were Christian friends who this issue is very, very real for them. And it's been many, many years. And so they're participating in it. So you're right. It is very much of an issue, not only being experienced by Christians, but also that they want to get their voice out about.
For sure. I think also we have a lot of Christians just buying into whatever the culture says is fine, without really critically thinking about it. And so I would hope that people would do research and look into the procedures and, you know, research their doctors and all of these things. But there's no guarantee that people are doing that intellectual work ahead of time. So I think as just, you know, I have not struggled with infertility. However, I can't have any more kids. So my concern as a Christian is I have a lot of, you know, I mentor young women. I have a lot of friends who are struggling with infertility. And how do I, as like a mentor for a lot of young women, how do I talk them through if they end up with these kind of issues? So I think being equipped as a Christian to be able to navigate different ethical issues is important, whether or not you personally are affected by them.
I want to specifically ask you about a documentary, a Netflix documentary that came out in 2022. And it's specifically a film that is following the story of a particular fertility doctor. Now, I, over the years, just for Christian Research Institute, we monitor various different news, you know, organizations and newspapers, you know, now online, of course. So The New York Times has done quite a bit on the new phenomenon, specifically now that a lot of these children that were conceived by donors are growing up. And because of the internet, you know, and you know, if you're adopted or you realize, oh, this is not my mom's egg, or I don't have a dad, or, you know, a physical dad in my life or whatever, and it was donor sperm, there's a lot of questions. So those kinds of things are coming up, and there's more and more stories about this. And this is one particular following of this particular fertility doctor. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about this Netflix documentary and what is some of the things that they cover about him and some of the ethical issues that they're looking into in the film?
Great. So in Our Father, it is a documentary. It's called Our Father, which I think is an intentional play on Christian, Our Father who art in heaven. It's a little, there are some digs at the Christian faith in this documentary. So fair warning for anybody who wants to watch it. But the documentary follows Dr. Donald Klein, I guess it follows his children more so. This doctor, it was found out that he had been operating as a fertility doctor in a small community for a long period of time. And slowly, as these children that were conceived in his clinic came of age and started taking commercial DNA tests, they kept finding out that they had lots of half-siblings that were showing up on these websites. So it follows Jacoba Ballard. She's pretty well known in like the donor conceived online community because she has been this voice behind fertility fraud. And that's what we find out, is that this doctor, Dr. Klein, had, instead of using chosen donor sperm or husband's donor sperm for some of the individuals who were going through fertility treatments, instead, he substituted his own sperm and impregnated 94. They now have 94 children documented in this sibling pod. So at least 94 times he lied to a patient, and it resulted in a live birth. So it was likely much more than the attempts that were made. The New York Times, actually, in the review of this documentary, says it is like a crime drama. It definitely paints the picture of this criminal action that's taking place. And currently, there are no federal laws prohibiting this kind of behavior. So where Dr. Klein swapped chosen donor DNA with his own, it is not something that he can be brought up on charges for. And there are other things he did end up getting in trouble for, but they weren't related to that. And so the documentary raises the question, how is this not illegal? And it's a great example, and it kind of brings to the forefront of the conversation this problem that the fertility industry has outpaced the laws that are supposed to be regulating it. And so you're left wondering, why is it, like, how can people get away with this? It seems clearly wrong, but the fertility industry is being revolutionized with new technologies all the time. People are, you know, meeting with doctors and flipping through catalogs of donors and choosing future fathers or mothers of their children with these treatments without necessarily having the regulations that need to be in place to protect families from something like what Dr. Klein did. So I think we have the problem right now is that there are, now that people have done the DNA tests, we have over 50 doctors like Dr. Klein who have done this. And so it's not an isolated incident. And I think that's what's so disturbing about this documentary, is that they make the point that this is not isolated. With over 50 doctors, some people have estimated as high as 70 at this point. Just absolutely terrifying. And some of the doctors, there's one that's fairly local to me that I know are still in practice, and it's bizarre. You can go see these fertility doctors today, and they are still in practice.
That is really interesting, especially because there's now almost 100 biological children that he has, in addition to his actual two biological children, that just through these practices that he did that were unsuspecting. You know, some of the women, as you mentioned, thought that the sperm that was being used to impregnate them was from their own husband. So it's very, very interesting. I'm just wondering, you know, this idea of fertility fraud that you just talked about, it's unregulated. We don't, you know, there's not specific laws. And you said there's people still in practice doing these things, and, you know, giving treatments to women even after they had committed some fertility fraud. So why should fertility fraud really be of ethical concern to Christians as, you know, they consider this issue? Because, as I said, more and more Christians are turning to these kinds of procedures if they are unable to naturally conceive children.
Yeah, I think at the very base level, supporting an industry that thrives or promotes lying in so many documented ways seems scary to me. I think we need to take into consideration that there are going to be like you can't for sure make sure that the doctor is giving you the right sperm in the procedure necessarily. There are some lengths you could go to make sure that that's the case. But I would say consider what it would mean as, you know, if you're a married couple and you go see a fertility doctor and you say, you know, we're having trouble getting pregnant, you know, the sperm just is not reaching the egg. We need some help making sure that, you know, the husband's sperm is getting to where it needs to be. And once you participate in this industry, knowing that there are people who have suffered from fertility fraud, you are opening yourself up to the possibility that there could be a third party donor involved that's not the husband. And you actually see that in this particular documentary that I mentioned, in Our Father. There's a dad who you watch him break down on screen crying and saying, you know, for all these years, I thought this was my daughter, and it turns out I'm not biologically related to her. And working through the emotions of that must be so difficult. And I think even if you can come to the point as a Christian, if you have looked into all of the fertility treatments and you find, you know, morally justifiable ones that you'd like to participate in, I think opening yourself up to the possibility that it could not be what you're expecting is scary, for one, but also raises the question, should you even be giving money to people who are maybe not necessarily being ethical in how they're dealing with things?
But just because there is, I mean, I just wanted to ask you to clarify, you said that it's an industry that lies or is not exactly honest about things. I mean, just because there's these extreme cases like Dr. Klein, and there have been some other noted cases of doctors who have done this, does that necessarily mean that the entire industry, because it is unregulated, tends to do unethical practices?
I certainly think that there is a precedent for saying that. So even the first case of, well, it's one of the first cases of recorded donor insemination. This was back in 1884, one of the first documented cases of donor insemination. The woman, for context, the woman was able to carry a child. Everything was working on her end, but her husband was infertile. And so the doctor that was attending to her decided to do this procedure where she would be inseminated by, you know, they called him the most attractive medical student in the program. And so she signed on to this procedure thinking that it was going to be a medical student. And it all seemed to be what she was expecting, except for that the doctor switched out the chosen donor DNA with his own. And so the sperm that they used was, in fact, the doctor's. And it did result in a live birth. She ended up raising this child. This is, you know, this is so long before even the fertility industry was established as like an industry. I think it seems like it comes from the roots of the thing, that where there are situations where doctors are participating in the creation of life and participating in this fulfilling the lifelong longings of these women who want to have children and these men who want to be fathers, I think it leads to this very real worry of perpetuating kind of narcissistic, godlike complexes. And that, again, is something that is raised in the New York Times talks about this when they reviewed Our Father. They said there's this God complex at work. And I would say, you know, even in the very beginning, if this is the inclination of doctors to swap chosen donor sperm with their own, it's likely a lot more prevalent than we think it is. Only 20% or so, 21% of Americans have taken a commercial DNA test. We don't know for sure how many people this has happened to. Now that fertility treatments have become very popular since the 70s. So we could very well have a whole lot more people related than, you know, we necessarily think to the doctors that were had a hand in creating them, you know?
A super big shout out to BS Sparks 58. Thank you so much for posting a review of this podcast on Apple Podcasts. It's our first one, April 2023, since last September in 2022. Thank you so much for helping us out with the algorithm and for letting people know about this podcast, which, by the way, I'd like to let our listeners know we are going towards 350 episodes since 2016. You can expect to hear Phil Tallon, who was here for the very first one, be on episode 350 later this summer, and you won't want to miss that one. Please spread the word about this podcast. Let people know about our interviews that we have with our various different authors, and you won't want to miss out on some of the content that's coming up. Now, normally I don't preview content, but I just want to let you know about some of the interesting things that we have coming up in addition to Phil coming up for our big 350th episode that we're going to do in the summer. But also, you know, if you have been online, you've noticed that one of the biggest hits this year in terms of television series is HBO's series The Last of Us, based on the very popular video game. We are going to have an episode coming out about that. And also, we are going to be reviewing the book Beautiful Union by Josh Butler. And we also have more Ancient Aliens coming up, and an update on the current situation with the Church of England as kind of a news segment that we haven't done news in a while. So you don't want to miss out on any of those. Please feel free to continue to share all of our content. And we're really grateful. Tell a friend, let people know about this podcast. And now back to the conversation about donor conception and the ethics of the fertility industry with Lisa Cooper.
So I think people at least know the, you know, stereotype from the movies or something. When people want a designer baby or they're not able to have one, how do they actually decide on who the donor would be? And so usually there's some kind of catalog or database that tells you their education and their characteristics that they have, physical perhaps, or their interests. And why would that pose an ethical problem for Christians, especially like in the example that you gave of more than 100 years ago was the husband that was infertile. And so they had to have donor sperm at that point for this woman to conceive. So for Christians, is that an ethical problem when you are thinking about flipping through a catalog? Now, sometimes this is true. Some Christians might be unmarried, women who want to have children and have not gotten married, and then they decide that they will have a donor. So they will go and look at those. So there's not a husband involved in the process. But how is this just really something that is an ethics that Christians have to grapple with when they think of coming to a database and looking for various different characteristics that they're interested in for a baby?
It's so strange to think that we can play God in these situations like this. And I think that's maybe my biggest concern is once you are profiling people based on most of its looks or intelligence on paper, and it's completely divorced from the person themselves. In America, we're, you know, we have lots of anonymous donors that are participating in the fertility industry. And so it's hard when you are a mom who really desperately wants to have a child and there's no husband in the picture, and you can flip through and construct a perfect man, exactly who you'd want to be the father of your child, except for they're not going to be the father of your child. And so, you know, biologically speaking, yes, but not necessarily when it comes to, you know, supporting them and raising them and being in their lives and being present. And so I think a lot of women have to wrestle with the ethical implications of choosing to have children, not only out of wedlock, but also out of like completely devoid of a partner in general and the support that a partner would bring. And there are so many donor stories. There's this great I say great. It's really tragic. This website called anonymousus.org. I think it's .org. I linked it in my article, so people will be able to find it. But there are so many cases where these children who are donor conceived are saying things like, well, my mom really, really wanted a kid, and I was supposed to be the thing that completed her life and made her a mom and made her all of the things that she wanted to be. And really getting being conceived by a sperm donor puts all this pressure on this child that they need to be the thing that fixes their problems or be the thing that validates them as a woman. And it may not be the intention of the mother, but it certainly is something that is felt by donor-conceived individuals. And so I think we have to take into account that those feelings are very present. And ethically speaking, is it right to have a family where you don't have a father who's present? I mean, that's something people have to wrestle with too. How do we deal with people raising kids on their own and not in the context of a family? And I do think that there is, from a Christian perspective, we would talk about how God has designed the family with a man and a woman and said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And God's design and desire for people is that they would be in this family unit, and that would be ultimately like fruitful and helpful and provide companionship and all of the things that are good about being in a relationship with another person. When you abstractify childbearing from marriage and from companionship, there are moral and ethical implications to that. So I think those are things, and I'm not offering an answer. I'm just saying that those are things that need to be wrestled with. And I do believe that there are Christians who are likely listening to this who have wrestled with this and come to a different conclusion than I would come to. But I do think that scripture does present certainly the male and female marriage bond as the place where children are, you know, conceived and brought into the world. And so you have to be able to wrestle with that for sure.
In your article, you discuss donor anonymity. And why is the issue of donor anonymity need to be something of concern for potential parents who are receiving, in particular, well, we're mainly talking about sperm donors, but I'm assuming that, you know, if they're tend to be, you know, I don't think you can have as many eggs, obviously, but that there's also women that have donated eggs more than once too. So if you talk about donor anonymity, why is this a concern for potential parents that would receive the sperm or eggs that they could be using?
This is such, there are so many reasons why this is hard to deal with. So first of all, there's another documentary that it like follows along with a group of children who it's called Future People. It follows these children who are all conceived by the same father. There's another one called Donor Unknown, where a young man is like trying to trace his biological father. And in the process, there are lots of half siblings and people. It's like a whole big puzzle that these people have to put together to try and find out who their family is. So first of all, there is the problem that just people don't know who their parents, their biological parents are. In the case of adoption, sometimes this is true as well, but in situations where you're making an agreement with the doctor, let's say, as like a couple, and you say, we're going to protect the anonymity of the donor, we're not going to tell our kids that, you know, who the father is, or and they may not even know. There it may just be like a vial with a number on it. And that often happens, is that there's just a vial with a number on it and the parents don't even know who the biological parent is. But this leads to a lot of feelings of unrest and lots of searching for who am I? I just want to know what my identity is. And I think there are problematic ways that we can struggle with identity. And certainly we see that more so in our culture today than I think maybe ever before, that people have this, I need to self-actualize and find out who I am, who I truly am. And so barring like an excessive view of that, where maybe your ideas of who you are based in something that comes from within you or something, that there certainly is something to knowing your biological family and feeling like you're part of something beyond just yourself. And I think a lot of the donor-conceived individuals who have made their testimonies public have struggled with this. I just want to know who I am. So certainly there's that. But on a very practical level, there are so many issues when there is no like donor registry that spans all of the different clinics and cryobanks in America. And so it's very difficult to track one donor across multiple banks and across multiple clinics. And so, for example, and I think sperm donation is the easier way to talk about this, because, you know, when people are donating eggs, it's such an invasive and difficult procedure. But when you have an anonymous donor who, let's say that they're, you know, 20 years old when they come in and make a donation, a sperm donation, and from that they go on to live their life, and 18 years later, they find out, oh, I have a critical heart condition that I need to deal with. At that point in their life, are they thinking clearly about, I'm going to call up the cryobank I donated to, you know, 18 years ago and let them know that I have a, you know, a physical problem that they need to be aware of? That child that they donated to create is already an adult themselves. And at that point, they're oftentimes clinics have not kept great track of records. And there are many people who have come forward and said, I've requested medical records and they just don't have them. There is currently no federal mandate for clinics to verify the medical data that's provided when a donor comes in. And so many clinics just let you self-report your medical data. So, for example, the guy comes in and says, I'm a healthy 20-year-old. I have no medical history and everybody in my family's healthy. They have no, the clinic itself has no mandate that they need to verify that. So there are currently some laws being brought up in different states. I know there's one in New York State that is proposing that they have to do that. They have to verify the medical data. But if you have a critical heart condition, that's something you want to get scanned for from a very young age. And so not only the donor-conceived child, but also any future offspring that they have, medical history really does make a difference. If you're equipped with a good medical history, you can scan and test for things that might run in the family and ultimately protect you, your own physical health, and your offspring, future offspring, as a donor-conceived person. So I think there's a reason why there are bans against anonymity in donations in Australia, Germany, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Sweden, New Zealand, the UK, and Norway. So there are many places in the world where this is illegal because they want to make sure that people have not only a verified medical history, but also they want to be able to track and trace donor across multiple banks and things. So I do think it's very important that people take into consideration that anonymity doesn't just affect like the one generation of donor conceived people. It affects all of their future offspring if they don't have accurate medical data.
And that does seem a little concerning, especially when you think of the Netflix documentary and Dr. Klein, because he fathered 95 biological children, and you know, they someday those people will get married. You know, There's another, I read this guy's story in the New York Times as well. There's another man in the Netherlands. He's been in the news because he's fathered more than 500 children through sperm donation. And it's been through different clinics all over the world. And, you know, obviously he's being sued now. And I want to ask you about serial donation because, of course, now some people were doing it illicitly, like Dr. Klein. But I think, you know, sperm donation, I guess, could kind of be like the new blood donation. I mean, if people can get money or they're young, like you were saying in your example, like, you know, you're a college student, you just need money. Sure, here's my sperm. You're not really thinking of, oh, someone could pick this multiple times and I could, you know, have all these children that I don't know about out in the world. You mentioned other countries where some of this is illegal, but what about serial donation in the United States? So how is that handled? Because, you know, Dr. Klein was in the United States and I just mentioned that this man in the Netherlands has had some legal action, but also I want to tell our listeners that Dr. Klein did too. I mean, as of last year, he's had to settle more than $1 million worth of lawsuits over groups of these children suing him in a civil court. But, you know, are there any safeguards so that people can say, okay, I can feel confident if I'm going to make this choice as a Christian to go and use donor sperm? You know, how do I know that there's not serial donations out there or that would cause a problem for a child I would bring into the world later on if there was just too many children conceived by a certain person?
Yeah, I think this guy is such an interesting case study. This guy, Jonathan Jacob Meyer, he's because there are rules and regulations against serial donation, that's why charges have been brought up against him in the Netherlands. And so he's been all over the world donating, both in clinics, cryobanks, and just one-on-one donations, like through people use Facebook Marketplace for sperm donations now. Fun fact. So apparently you can just, you know, go on the internet and get somebody's sperm and, you know, if that's like the cheapest option. So this guy capitalized on that and he's been watched for many years. There have been many different articles written about him, but recently when litigation was brought against him, it's been confirmed that he has somewhere around 550 children all throughout the world that we know of. And so serial donation, the reason why anonymity is also prohibited in some of these states or in countries is anonymous donors can lead to things like accidental incest. And the lawsuit pending against this man actually stipulates that he is heightening the risk of accidental incest. And in the case of Dr. Klein, because he was in one location at a fertility clinic for so many years, like his whole career, he's in this one fertility clinic in one place, and impregnating so many women in that community, that also can lead to accidental incest, especially when it's like a smaller subsection of people that are, you know, receiving the one man's sperm. So it is something that can not only like that whole God complex that I talked about before, this bizarre narcissism that can motivate some people to act in this way. It also can cause these extremely large sibling pod sizes where you just have no real way to track and trace all of these kids across all of the different places that they've gone, especially if they don't get DNA tested and they don't know who their biological parent is. It makes it very, very difficult to think that this is a good idea. I think you can't really fully be certain. There's no like tracking of donors across different cryobanks or clinics in America. There's no federal mandated size cap for sibling pods. And so there are recommendations that are made that people shouldn't be donating excessively. But I think a lot of people don't realize too, even if you are a sperm donor one time, and if everything goes perfectly and you walk into the clinic and you donate your sperm, one vial of sperm, you might think, okay, maybe there's an off chance that it works and one child comes into the world. I don't think people realize that they will often take vials and break them up into multiple sellable vials. And so if everything goes perfectly and that one donation could theoretically result in multiple children, and 18 years later, if you live in Colorado, Colorado's the only state that I know of that has a law in place that says you have the right to know who your donor parent is at 18 years old. So if you live in that state, you know, 18 years later, that you might have multiple children knocking on your door saying, oh, hey, you're my biological father. And so serial donation becomes a huge problem when you have these enormous pod sizes of children. You have accidental incest potential, especially in smaller communities. But certainly, I think people also don't realize that each individual donation, sperm donation, is actually multiple sperm donations, which just makes it exponentially more scary.
Well, there's an article, I read it when it came out at the time, 2 years ago, in the New York Times, that's just talking about these serial sperm donors. And we're, you know, talking about this right now. And there is one, you know, the one that you talked about, Mr. Meyer, but there's also another donor in the Netherlands again, and his name is Lewis. And so far they've traced 200 kids to him. And in the article itself, you know, they talked to some of these siblings of this donor, and they're in their 30s. And they were saying that one guy was saying he's matched on Tinder, which is a dating app. He's matched with several of his sisters, actually. So he matched with four of them. So it's, you know, but, and I think he probably realized it because they, like you said, they have a big pod, and then, you know, he's checking it out because he knows that he's somebody was conceived in this manner. But so even in that country, even now, and, you know, that was a few years ago, and he said he matched with them a few years before that. It's just coming out even more, you know, information. And just that guy had 200, and we don't know, you know, if it's anonymous, how many times did someone donate? And every time, do they use their real name? And in the case of Mr. Meyer, he was donating at different clinics in different parts of the world. So it's going to be, I don't know if there is there some kind of international database where you could, you know, if you know that you've been, you know, your origins were from donor sperm, is there somewhere you could go internationally just to make sure?
No. I think the only thing you can do is get a DNA test and see if you match up with people. But there is no registry that's international. There's no registry that's American even. It's just by clinic.
So those are definitely some things for food for thoughts. Now, you are using this term called sibling pod sizes, and you just said that they're not really strictly monitored in America. Why are they referred to sibling pods? And besides incest and health things, why is this just kind of a big issue to have an unregulated way, like you said, since it's not tracked internationally, to try to connect potential siblings?
Yeah, I can't remember the statistic off the top of my head, but there is a recommended sibling pod size. So the pods, the reason why they use that terminology, I'm not exactly sure of the origin of it, but it seems to just indicate, as we find people who are related to one another by these like half degrees, because they're all half siblings, it's one way to just express that they're related to one another biologically, but not necessarily living together. They're not necessarily growing up in the same household. They're not necessarily in the same part of the country or the world even. So I think pod gives you this more expansive, maybe, term for siblings. Siblings we typically think of as being someone we grew up with, same parents, same maybe experience. So the sibling pod sizes are not monitored in America at all. There are, like I said, recommended guidelines. I wish I could remember off the top of my head what those are, but they are not enforced, and there's no federal law that says that they have to be a certain size. And so if you are a donor, there's no guarantee, if you participate in the industry as a donor, right, there's no guarantee that your donation is not going to be used more times than you think. So the people that may expect, oh, I'm donating one time, I'm going to have one child, they don't realize that it actually could be multiple children. And they certainly don't realize that if they go in on a regular basis, that those children, they may not actually cap it where they say that they might. So there are people who have come forward having donated, finding out that they've had way more children than they were supposed to. And that impacts, I think, the problem is that we're so individualistic in America that we assume my actions only impact me. And I think that's a major problem that we have. As Americans, and maybe people in general, we're very curved in on ourselves. We think about ourselves all the time, but not necessarily how our actions are actually going to affect other people. But here's a great example. So if a sibling pod is very, very big, let's say there are some that are over 100 that are being documented in America right now. There are some that are over 200. And there's a website that details a lot of this called Donor Deceived. And people can write in with their results of how many half siblings they've found. And they're currently tracking pods for this purpose, to try and bring litigation forward, saying that it's important to have these regulations in place because people shouldn't have to be that worried when they get on a dating app that they're going to find their sister or their brother. But it doesn't just affect those who are donor conceived. So for example, in the case that a person goes in and donates their sperm and their brother decides that he, you know, a younger brother, let's say, gets on a dating app and runs across this half niece. Like you're so closely related to these people that you're donating to. They're genetically, you know, half yours. I think people don't realize that it affects siblings and cousins of these children. And so the choice of one individual impacts an entire family, not just, you know, the family that they're donating to, that they get their child, that they want.
And this is really interesting. People can go on there, as you said, to the website Anonymous S, where people tell their stories. And one of the stories from a few years ago on there just shows why having an anonymous registry is dangerous, in that he had a grown daughter who is a lesbian, and she and her partner wanted to have a baby. So they went through sperm donation, and he had recently donated sperm. And then after the baby's born and all this stuff, they did the DNA testing. It turned out it was his own sperm that was used.
Yes. So I was going to bring up that same.
And of course he's really disgusted about it, because I believe that the egg that was used was his daughter's egg. So now he doesn't really have a relationship with his daughter. There is a child that will probably have some serious health issues, and also probably maybe mental health issues regarding the true, you know, identity of their biological father is actually their grandfather. So, and you know, of course, because of the fall, it's not like these particular, we're using technology and medicine and things like that to have these things happen. But as we know, there's stories of these things that have happened in the Bible when you think of Lot and his daughters. But yet the Bible is very clear in Leviticus that any kind of sexual relations with relatives or even people who, you know, are in-laws, you know, you might not be their blood relatives, but, you know, your mother-in-law or whatever is forbidden in the Bible. And so I think Christians need to seriously think about that. But these kinds of things can happen for sure. And like you said, how do you really ensure that the specimen of sperm that's being used is the exact specimen that you think it is, whether it's your spouse's or something that you think you've selected, and not something else that could potentially result in your child being part of a sibling pod of hundreds of children.
Right.
So, of course, you'd have to think, you know, with anything like this and with any unregulated industries, things are become very expensive, and it's because it's built on hope and desires and emotions for people to, especially when children are considered, you know, that people want to believe that they can have children. They want to have children. You mentioned stories about people who, you know, they felt like supposedly they were supposed to change their mother's whole life and they didn't change their mother's whole life. But I would assume that there's a lot of money that is behind this industry and these different clinics. And so what kind of dollar amounts are we talking about when you're talking about the fertility industry and especially the unregulated portions of it?
Well, the industry itself is estimated to be a $7.9 billion industry. And that is it's mostly reliant on a consistent stream of donors. And those donors are receiving, you know, if you're a sperm donor, you could make, you know, $1,000 or so a week, which is like a part-time job. And there are college students that have come forward and said that they donated consistently throughout college to make ends meet because they didn't have time for a part-time job. So this $7.9 billion industry offers all of these incentives that are money related to people so that they'll continue to donate on a regular basis. And so, like I said, that there are like multiple sellable vials from one donation. So people think that they're being compensated for one donation when really it's being, you know, divided up into multiple vials and used to create multiple children. And those families that are holding out hope and they're putting all of their eggs in this basket, you know, maybe a crass metaphor, but, you know, they're thinking that this is going to be it. I'm going to get a child, and they're willing to pay the money for it. And any of the procedures that they participate in are going to cost money. And so it's not, I also think that this is a stewardship issue, and it's too bad. There are so many things I could have talked about in this paper, but as a stewardship issue, you have to, as Christians, we have to think about what our money is being used for and whether or not it's wise to spend our money pursuing things like this. And so, you know, in the case that Christians often get so hung up on the idea that we need to be parents in order to be full Christians, or there's some level of sanctification that we achieve by being selfless and being parents, that when it's hard and or when you're experiencing infertility, that hope and that self-actualization, or if for lack of a better term, that comes with being the parent that you think you deserve to be, it can really affect your priorities and how you're spending your money, how you're engaging in a business like this. And so I think we have to be critical about that and think through whether or not it's a wise way to spend money and whether or not it's a wise way to make money. Is it okay to exchange money for a child? Like, is that ethically permissible as Christians? You know, that's something we have to wrestle with.
So one thing you bring up in your article is that there are a lot of young donors, whether they be women or men, sperm and eggs, that the fertility industry is targeting to give donations. And so what are some of the ways that they do target those folks? Because you did give an example like, oh, you know, some guy's probably like, yeah, you know, I guess I get some money. It's kind of like donating blood and I'm 18 and I won't care. But then later on in life, 25 years later, he's got a heart condition. And then that was never disclosed because you don't have to disclose this kind of information. So how do they particularly try to use young people to become donors?
It is fascinating. If you look up, there are ways to find like maps of where cryobanks and clinics are located. They choose places near colleges very frequently. And so even in the real estate market for cryobanks clinics, they often end up right near colleges. And there's a reason for that. They will hang posters. They're reports from students seeing, you know, donate now, like all over campus posters. TikTok is becoming a very prolific way where people can spread the message. You know, it's great to be a donor. I'm, you know, making this huge impact on people's families. And you can get these like very short encapsulated, you know, testimony stories about how wonderful it is to be an egg donor or a sperm donor. And, you know, with influencers on the internet saying, hey, I was blessed to be selected to do this kind of thing where I get to help out these families. And it becomes this idea of the honor of being selected. And as a young person, there's a lot of maybe seeking that kind of attention. They want validation, but also just the cool factor of it being on campus, it being something that you can do for extra money. They're often the ads that are targeted toward younger people are led with the monetary compensation piece. So, you know, if you want to donate your eggs, you're going to get up to $10,000 in some places. And they're going to pay for your travel. They're going to give you health benefits. You're going to get medical insurance. You're going to get all of these great things. They're going to fly you places so that you can see doctors and, you know, there's a free physical involved. You get all of these like great perks, it sounds like, and you're going to make all this money. And it's just, it's to target the young folks. And to be fair, there are biological incentives for young egg donors. There are reasons why, like, they have better outcomes with women who are younger with their eggs in successfully having live births. However, with sperm donors, they've done testing that there is no biological difference in live birth outcomes. There's no meaningful difference between an 18-year-old and a 45-year-old. And so when they're targeting these young men, especially with the cryobanks, they, you know, they have these posters. I cited one in the article too, where it has just like this clenched hand and there's a voiceover saying, you're already doing it. Why not get paid for it? And who does that appeal to? Like college students, right? I think maybe part of it is like coming of age and feeling like you have autonomy over your body and feeling like you can make ends meet by making some extra money this way. I think that the fertility industry targets these young people with this great marketing scheme. It's accessible. You can go in between classes and donate, make some money. But I do think that targeting young people should raise ethical questions for Christians when we, like, are they fully informed about the ramifications of their actions? And especially with egg donation, they found that there isn't, like, long-term testing for a lot of these hormone treatments that the women have to endure in order to gather eggs at a specific time. And there are testimonies on the internet of lots of women coming forward and saying they overstimulated, you know, my ovaries and I ended up, you know, donating 30 eggs in one procedure instead of like a normal amount. And that can lead to some serious health conditions where people can die on the table. And I don't know that a college student who's being targeted and told that they're going to receive $10,000 and medical insurance when maybe they're in a hard economic situation, I think that seems more like bribery in some cases, maybe, or maybe just problematic in how attractive it would seem for somebody who's really suffering and struggling to make ends meet.
Now, we've shared a lot of different stories, and they do seem extreme, except for sadly that they're true. And so, again, people can watch the documentary, or they can also go to the Anonymous Us and see more stories. But regarding these personal stories, you know, once you hear about them, and we've mentioned some, how should Christian people think about the industry as they hear these stories and as they consider and literally pray about, should we embark on a journey that involves anything from, you know, artificial insemination, because that's the very entry point, artificial insemination, because before, you know, all of this came to light, people just assumed, oh, artificial insemination, it's the spouses, the husband goes in, we do this, it's just routine. And so before all these stories, I don't think anyone would have ever thought that, well, maybe there are unethical doctors not actually using sperm from the husband. So as all these stories have come out, you know, how should Christians process this, especially if they're struggling with infertility?
I think one of the main things, it's hard as humans to look at other people and validate their experience. And so it can be really easy to just look at the facts and say, it's a medical procedure. And, you know, those are just some bad eggs that ended up in the industry, and we can kind of write that off as something not normative. And maybe that's it. You just say, well, it's not that big of a deal. But when you start reading stories, even from the people who have been conceived using donor insemination, who have not experienced the fraud end of this, and yet they still are wrestling with so many deep lasting traumas from it, I think it should spur us on as Christians to consider how this hurts and or helps our neighbor. So, you know, we can kind of maybe justify to ourselves, participating in this kind of an industry is not so bad. But when we hear the human side of it, we should care about our neighbor, and be willing to bear their burdens. And I know some of it's more abstractified because the people are further away from us than maybe close relations. But when people are expressing deep hurt and fragmentation and fear and loneliness and problems with feeling connected because they don't really know who they are, I do think that we should take them at their word and evaluate these procedures in light of it. And maybe say, maybe I shouldn't participate in this kind of an industry, you know, if it's going to effectively hurt people in the long run, even if they're not yet born.
So how can Christians compassionately navigate these ethical questions with other people in their church, or maybe it's people in their own families that are going through that, and they're struggling with infertility, which is so heartbreaking for so many people. And, you know, you hear many stories of women, you know, cycles after cycles, many tens of thousands of dollars invested, and they are not wanting to particularly use adoption as a route to start their family. They really do want to have their own biological children. How can Christians really be there to encourage and also maybe help people see some of the ethical issues involved and do it in a compassionate way? Because as I said, there's a lot of heartbreak involved in infertility.
For sure. I think as Christians, I think our main concern should be, you know, loving our neighbor and bringing them hope in the gospel. And it is very difficult to navigate suffering in this world. And, you know, we can learn from lots of negative examples in scripture, right? Where Job's friends will sit with him and tell him why he's wrong instead of mourning with him. And we have a very important duty as Christians to come alongside and, you know, bear one another's burdens and care for people who are struggling. But that doesn't absolve us from raising questions, having those kind of conversations with people who are struggling with infertility, even if it's just asking questions. Have you thought about this? Have you thought about this procedure? Have you talked to this doctor that, you know, is local to us? Finding out about where they are and what their thought process is, I think, helps navigate those conversations. But ultimately, I think in any relationship where you're close with the individual who's struggling, I think the best thing to do is like care for them well, and support them in what they're doing. And if there are major ethical concerns, you know, maybe you find out your friend is a serial donor to the industry. I would be very concerned at that point. like that would be a time to bring up that this is a problem. You shouldn't be being deceptive about how many times you're donating or if you're lying to your family about it or something. But for the people who are struggling with infertility and thinking about engaging in the fertility industry in order to start their family, I think the best thing to do is, you know, there are so many ways you can encourage people with scripture that suffering is part of the Christian life and it stinks, but it also is not the plan for all of eternity. You know, our longings this side of heaven are not the end, and there is nothing this side of heaven that's going to complete us in the way that we may long to be completed. We ultimately have the hope of the, you know, death and resurrection of Jesus to take away our sins, to secure with us a place in heaven forever, and the ultimate promise of resurrected bodies that function the way that they're supposed to, and they don't have those same problems that we might suffer with this side of heaven. So I think there are plenty of ways you can bring scripture into the conversation, but ultimately I think I would abide by the Colossians, you know, let your speech be seasoned with salt. I would be careful and thoughtful and hopefully encouraging, but it is a case-by-case basis, right? There's no one-size-fits-all for encouraging someone who's struggling and who's suffering. So I think the best encouragement is just do the best you can in navigating those conversations, asking questions, but ultimately let love win in how you speak with people, because it is so private and difficult to even disclose issues of infertility to other people. So if you're in the know, chances are they want you to participate in that conversation, at least in some way.
And with so many huge sibling pods, it's not unimaginable that there are people who are devoted Christians who are donor conceived. I mean, how should they move forward and be a Christian witness in such a unique position?
Wow. I mean, it's got to be hard because you have to deal with all of the baggage of feeling incomplete in some way, and maybe not. Maybe they had a great upbringing that they felt very confident in who they were as people. But I do think that there is something so awesome about being able to say, I find my identity in Jesus, and that's more important than any biological parent that I have. And I do think from that, being donor conceived puts you in a position where that is maybe, if you're, you know, in the case that you don't know the donor, you have a unique opportunity to say that and mean it, you know? But I do think that they're sharing the struggles that come alongside a lot of this, the things that happen in this industry, feeling alone, feeling fragmented. These are like words that show up a lot in people's testimonies. I think being able to share that in a way that is clear to people in your own life, and maybe you don't have to broadcast it online or publicly or whatever, but in the case that somebody feels led to do that, I certainly think that it's very helpful to other Christians who are trying to navigate this stuff. That I think people's personal experiences really do matter when you're dealing with creating life and what it means to be human, even in being donor conceived.
Well, this has been a very fascinating and just a kind of informational podcast, just to know that there's so many hundreds of people that are struggling with these things in a very real way, from the people who want to have children all the way to the people who are donor conceived. But now on a much lighter note, I have a question for you, because it's May and we're looking forward to the summer that's coming up. So what's the best vacation that you have ever been on?
Oh my goodness. I would have to say probably visiting Seattle I haven't done a lot of traveling, but visiting Seattle was really fun. But somehow by some fluke, the week I went there, it was sunny the whole week. There was no rain. I got to try all the coffee and all the good food.
Well, great. Well, thank you, Lisa, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to episode 338 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest, Lisa Cooper, has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal. It's called, Is Participating in the Fertility Industry Ethical? You can read her article for free online at our website, equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.